Welcome to Writing the Wrong Way, where we talk about how writing works, how writers work, and how the best writers risk being strange. And I'm talking to Matt Menney around the office here. We like to call Heavy Metal Matt, although he's now left Heavy Metal. But he was, until recently, the CEO of Heavy Metal, which is kind of how we get to know each other, Matt, because Gregory Kmicik, my partner, and I pitched you and the company a book called The Eye Collector.
Which I still am absolutely obsessed with.
Yeah, and so we were really thrilled. The way that I always kind of talk about the experience of it and kind of getting to know you is like, one, we were just startled that every time we had a meeting about the book with, you know, the publisher, it was pretty much always with you. I remember one time Gregory and I were like, why is the CEO talking to us all the time? It's like, is there like no one lower than the CEO at that company? But we would get introduced to all these people who, like, you know, were also working there. And we were just like, this guy was just like the book, you know. But it boiled down eventually, because it's a very weird book, you know. And it just became very clear with that and with how we were kind of like getting hooked into what you guys were doing. And also with how some of the other books I saw you putting out, like BioRipple and stuff. Like, we just got very clear, like, oh, this guy just likes our book, you know, and he's like,
exactly.
They're pulling strings.
I always like to say I'm a creative first, which, you know, as you allude to, I left Heavy Metal and focus more now on creative endeavors. And I always just thought that Eye Collector was a very strange, peculiar, in the best way possible title, like BioRipple, which I think is also just incredible book by Nir, I think Levine. Those two books just had an art style from Gregory, and Nir wrote his drew his as well, and writing by you, that brought to me what felt like a 70s version of Heavy Metal back. Something that the art was provocative and the story was mind-bending.
Well, yeah, I was very pleased to say that, because working with that company has been kind of a dream come true. I always tell the story of, like, when I moved away from my parents' place, I was on a bus to Winnipeg here, where I now still live. And I remember getting a copy of Heavy Metal, like, from the newsstand. It was the first magazine I ever bought with my own money, you know, and I was like, literally, like, reading Heavy Metal, reading Jodorowsky, and, you know, just kind of thinking like, man. You know, if I only I could be in Heavy Metal, and like, that's, you know, where maybe one of these days, if I just keep pursuing this road, I'll get to that point. So it was really kind of a dream come true for us. But also, it was a thing where it was very surprising, and one that we were always talking to, like, people who actually had real pull at the company, like, as opposed to just, you know, normally the experience of a publisher is like, you're rarely talking to somebody who really matters at the publisher when you're talking to these larger publishers. But then the other thing was, I remember, like, it being the fairest contract I ever saw from a publisher, which I thought was hilarious. So I was like, wow, this is, you know, something's got to be wrong. You know, it's something. But, you know, yeah, we've had a really great time. But, you know, and one of the great things has just been getting to kind of know you and, like, getting to kind of work with you on stuff. And then now that you've kind of taken off to kind of focus more on your own projects, again, I wanted to kind of get you on here to talk not about Heavy Metal so much, but about sort of what you're doing and just sort of the experience of being a writer, working in genre. You know, you're primarily, you know, you work in science fiction in some way, shape, or form. But you're also a guy who does a lot of series. You're working comics and also in prose. And you're, you know, a business guy who pursues, you know, all sorts of media pursuits. And so I'm really interested. I think my audience kind of primarily is composed of writers, you know, who are trying to make it in this business. And, you know, it is kind of a select club in some ways, like people who manage to make it in this business. My contention always is that, yes, it requires writing and work and the ability and you know, this creativity and this creative thrust, but it also kind of requires just having a handle on your shit, you know, like knowing what is
totally
how to navigate, like, talking to someone and pitching in a room and whatever. So just to boil it down to a simple question, I wonder if we could just kind of maybe start with sort of like, what are your projects that you're kind of in now that you can talk about or that you just put out. That'll give us, I think, people listening a bit of a sense of what you just have got out now recently and they could check out, but also like just the practicalities of how you deal with doing all that stuff on a day-to-day totally. Basis.
What's interesting about what you said, there's sort of like three arms to writing. There's, pitching the story to someone that's willing to buy it. There's the actual writing of it, and then there's the marketing of it. And unfortunately, if you're not great at all three, then you're probably not going to see much success, even though you might have an amazing story. And that is I think that's actually a problem with the industry today. I think that an unintended consequence of user tools like self-publishing, et cetera, is the demand of writers having to also be their own marketers. It used to not be that way, right? There's obviously, and we can get into this later, I just want to start here. There's obviously tons of value to all of the tools that have gone to the fingertips of indie writers and creators, et cetera. But one of the more interesting sort of unintended consequences, as I said, is the need now that you can't just be a writer. You kind of have to be multi-hyphenate and understand that writing is a third of the process of getting your book published and read. With that being said, some of the projects I have right now is Beyond Kuiper, the Galactic Star Alliance. The hardcover came out just last year. There we go. That was the original cover, original print. That was pretty fun. That one sold out at the distributor level, which is pretty great. And now we have a different cover and some extra bonus material in the back. Book two is trudging along. That book is 313 pages, I think, something around there. Book two's manuscript is hovering around 600 right now. And
wow, that's crazy.
We're
it's like part of a 9-book series or something too, isn't it? This is a massive series, this one.
Yeah, it's going to be a massive series. It's going to take about 15 years to write. We have the whole thing mapped out. The reason it takes so long for, viewers and listeners of this that don't know the series is it's extremely hard science fiction. So John Connolly, my co-creator and co-author, is a aerospace engineer at one of the big companies. I can't obviously disclose which one for security purposes, because his actual role is celestial ground support lead for the deep space division. And I say that to preface that the science in that book is at the most elite level. We spend painstaking amounts of time to make sure that ships, gravity, metric systems, oxygen, the biology of the species that is on a nitrogen-rich planet versus a hydrogen-rich planet, all of the real ultra nerdy stuff is really hammered in there. So we're hoping to have book two ready for 2024. We said we were going to have it ready for 2023. Unfortunately, there's a science piece in how two of our characters get to a certain inflection point that took us a little bit longer to nail down the logistics of how they would move in space that far in that period of time. But I can talk about that for hours on end, but that's Beyond Kuiper. Above the Ground, which just came out as well, the print version hit stores in January. That book is near and dear to my heart. I actually conceived the concept while on a ski trip with my buddy Matt DiNuzzo, and then got introduced to Robert Greenberger, who's of Star Trek and Predator legacy. And when I got introduced to him, one of the things that I was told was Robert, or Bob, is a master sort of historical researcher. And what's really important about above the ground is the reality of this underground civilization that you meet. I'm not going to tell you more than that. And we really want to get the science of that correct. Really wanted to hone in on that. And I think we did a pretty good job at making that feel realistic. And what I'll tell you about the book is that it is my three favorite subgenres of science fiction broken into each of the three acts. The first act is dystopian sci-fi thriller. Second act is a treasure hunt of discovery. And the third act is time travel. And I always thought it'd be fun to put mesh a bunch of these subgenres together and see what came out the other side. And that's Above the Ground. Another book that is out. So those are my prose books that are out. I have a handful of graphic novels. A book called The Fifth Force, right here, that I wrote with the team at Hero and with a former diplomat to Canada, Catherine Loubier, who's worked with, I'm sure you probably know her name, worked with the president and premier of Canada and Quebec. We wrote a time-traveling thriller about clean energy and sort of the pros and cons and the ways in which to implement, implement clean energy into society was the mandate for that book, which is really fun. The goal of it is to get it into schools and libraries. We think that there's a really rooted educational undertone to the time traveling extravaganza that it is. We have Stable, which is three arcs, two worlds, one chance at survival. Have you finished that one yet?
This one I did, but I don't want to talk about the ending because you got that turn. But it has a really clever move, yeah. Which I should have seen coming. I didn't, but I, you know, in retrospect, that's the best kind of turn, right? It's like, oh, I should.
I love that. Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things, and I think we did a pretty good job of it. Where after you see it, you're like, I should have saw it coming, but I felt like we did a pretty good job at weaving dissent throughout it, so that it was sort of hidden in plain sight. There's a couple of misdirections that happen in the middle of Act Two that sort of throw you off that as a thought process, which was, you know, carefully engineered so that that ending would not necessarily be the first thing you thought coming. But what's really great about it, what I will talk about with Stable, is two things. One is the art style. We, Francisco Pizza, who's freaking incredible. Sorry.
You can swear if you want.
Oh,
I do whatever I want to do on this thing.
Francisco Pizza did an incredible job with this idea that we had of spreads. So there are an enormous amount of two-page spreads in this book because we thought that it would be interesting to showcase the landscape with insets and allow people to imagine the story with the dialogue and the words, et cetera, through these sort of moments with inlets. And then obviously there's a ton of regular comic pages as well. But, you know, as you know, as a comic creator, you know, maybe in a four issue compiled graphic novel, maybe you have like a total of 4 to 8 spreads, one per sort of 22 pages, give or take. I think there's about 24 in this book.
Well, this is the conventional way people do things. I don't know, like, I'm kind of, in some ways, I'm new to comics, Matt. Like, The Eye Collector is actually the first comic I've written. Like, I've written tons of other stuff, but that was the first comic I wrote. That. No, I didn't want to tell you because I was like, you know, shocked that, you know, I got, but I was like, I'm a real student of literature. I've written lots of other things. So, you know, I guess I just picked it up pretty fast. But I was just like, Gregory pointed out to me at one point in the Eye Collector process, he's like, you know, he's like, this amount of spreads is not normal. He's like, I'm like, well, why wouldn't you want just crazy spreads all the time? He's like, well, yeah. He's like, I'll draw them. I like them. He's like, it is working, but like, this isn't normal. You realize that, right? He goes, you start working for another comics. You go to DC, you can't do spreads every half the issue can't be spreads. I was like, that
I
seems like a
love
missed opportunity, you know?
it. So we're of like mindedness on that one. And the other part is there's obviously space arcs because you can see them in the cover, and there's also people on Earth, and that's, you know, all sort of outlined on the back cover, sort of in the premise. But what we do is we take the people that are left on Earth and the people on the spaceship, and we intertwine their existences so that while you're following effectively 13, I believe, characters, it sort of is only six storylines. So it's not an immense amount of, you know, chalkboard with pins and red string going back and forth. It feels grand, but it has specific stories that you're really able to hone in on. And then the last book that's out currently is a book called Remnant, which is futuristic sci-fi noir. I don't think you have this one yet.
No, that one I don't have, but I gotta get it. That style looks so great. That noir,
It's amazing. I mean, the inside pages too are just
No, that's
incredible.
killer.
Yeah, Fabio, who did our pages, is just unbelievable. And this story is a classic spy rabbit hole thriller, and maybe robots are taking over the entire world, and maybe they're not, and we're gonna see it through the lens of a autobiographist named Abel Kane.
Now, let me ask you just a practical question that is also somewhat a creative question, which is, you know, why do so many series at once with all these different collaborators as opposed to just, you know, picking one, going and doing it? Like, I know they ask that question on some level, but I want you to explain to people like the reality and the math and the kind of creative approach there that's behind that, you know, that kind of what I think otherwise people might view as a scattershot approach. I don't think it is that, but I think, you know, as because a lot of these are series. So rather than just, you know, going down the rabbit hole of one series, then moving on to the next one, why the multiple series with multiple collaborators? Like what is the sort of creative and business logic of that?
First, I just think that one of the things that's innate in me is I need to tell a lot of stories. If you have a ton of stories and you're only telling one, then this conversation's for you. If you have one story that is the thing that's in your head, then disregard everything I'm about to say. But you know, for every one book that I decide to go into production on with a team, I have 25 other ideas that are, you know, vying for that slot. There's just an immense amount of stories that I really want to tell that I think are interesting and important and fun. I think that, you know, you only get to live once, right? And if you can tell stories, you tell stories. So that's like the creative side. From the business side, and you kind of alluded to this in what you said, the timing of getting books done, of getting them out into the world, of getting them read and seen is a time scale that most people are not comfortable with. These are, you know, 5 to 10 to 20 year cycles. You know, a lot of the movies that you love today, those books came out in the 80s, honestly. Like, you just don't even realize that. You know, I mean, the entire Marvel phase 1 through 3, based on the Infinity Gauntlet, is a 1970s comic.
And Jim Starlin, right?
Exactly. So, you know, the amount of time that things need to soak in the zeitgeist is not something that can really be manufactured. So the more you can get out sooner, the more chips you have on the board. Right now, that was the other thing that you were alluding to, is there needs to be options for opportunity on the board. And then, like, the last piece of it that I think is really important is you don't want to be, unless if you have only one idea and you really want to curate that a certain way, but you don't want to be unprepared for rapid success. If something takes off you want there to be other things for people to consume. So even if all of the books are not getting, you know, all of the sales that you want today, the beautiful thing about books, like music, is that they're evergreen. You know, as long as you wrote an evergreen story, which, you know, that should be your first thing, is that even if you're writing something that's politically motivated in the moment, you should find a way to make it timeless. That's a whole nother conversation that we can have.
But that's to some degree what you're doing and working in science fiction, right?
Totally.
You mentioned some of the clean, like you can talk about clean energy, you could talk about climate change. One of the books is very heavily into the science of climate change and sort of what that means. You can talk about terraforming, you can talk about, which also gets you into a conversation on economics. That's very much a conversation that's happening in the US today, right? Should we be going to
Exactly.
Mars?
Actually, Remnant is very economics based. There's a economic collapse that brings the reason that it's futuristic noir and they're all sort of dressed like the Roaring Twenties in 2443 is because the economy collapsed and they decided to go back to a simpler way of dressing back when humanity was at its best.
Sure. And so you get there's a political, kind of dimension to that and interrogating, is it possible to do that? Is it desirable to do that? There's all sorts of ways you can plug into current debates without having to necessarily tie yourself to those current debates. So like the second that Trump's out of the news, this thing here doesn't matter anymore. But maybe those ideas are still relevant. If they were in science fiction, the story would still work. The debate aspect, it's still what people don't often, who aren't writers, don't understand often about stories. I find is that they don't tend to understand how a lot of what drives a story is a philosophical debate, and kind of presenting two sides of an issue and sort of letting them war out in the idea level of the story.
Could
And so
not
to
agree
do
more.
that, yeah. And so, but to do that, you're kind of in a One, you're in a dangerous position if you really tie it to a current situation, because it's so tempting to take a side when, like, maybe the story will eventually take a side, but you need to play out both sides en route. And also, there's that level of it that is more important than what's going on in the world today. If that makes sense. And like, there's a
100%.
reason we still read The Island of Dr. Moreau, even though that science doesn't even make sense anymore. But, a lot of the ideas in the debate of it still are relevant.
A saying that I like to go by, a sort of mantra, is that all science started as fiction. Without the imagination, we wouldn't have thought that we were rotating around a star. Without imagination, we would not have thought that we could harness a star. And without imagination, we could never think of going to the stars, right? All of those things that are now science started off as fictional ideas, as hypotheses. And I think writing science fiction, you are, in a way, a philosopher of ideas. And I think it's important that when you're writing, that you sort of stay true and hold that dear to you, because if you're just writing for fun and you want to write a fun thriller or an action thing or whatever, that's awesome and you should do that. But I do think that if you're going into the realm of science fiction and really into the realm of hard science fiction, there has to be undertone allegories and themes and motivations of what you're saying, because the inspiration of other worlds should not come without a lesson.
Yeah, not only will the politics of the day change, the morals of the day will change, but even the science, will change. And so if you're just relying on any one of those things too much, then very quickly you get your story starts to become obsoleted. Like there's a level of obsolescence that can happen if you're too tied to some particular thing. We were actually joking earlier today, Matt and I have a are involved in a secret project, and when the science aspects of the
Alpha.
story, when the science aspects in the story I saw a news article that almost had the, like, scientists had developed it. So I
You
was
know
like
what's
texting to
really
Matt.
funny about that? We actually haven't talked about this yet. That is the third book in which a scientific idea that I created, or that we created, or I created with collaborators, from a story had a real world science article created for it later. It happened with Jan Kuiper. And it happened with, I want to say stable, but I also think it was actually, no, with Darkwing.
Sure.
There was a space.com article that said, could a planet power a spaceship? And I like dropped my coffee when I saw that headline. I was like, are you kidding me? What?
It's funny how that stuff will happen, you know. Like, but just kind of on that realm topic a little bit though, like, what appeals to you about working with collaborators so extensively? Because you're very, I mean, on one hand, it just makes sense that if you're gonna delve into really hard science, especially you maybe need someone to check the math with you, as it were.
Totally.
But what else kind of do you like about that collaboration process?
I think like the reality is art should be shared, and it's more fun to create something with people than it is to, do it on your own. I've written a bunch of things that I just write, and it's fun, and I enjoy the process of getting into the characters and hearing them in my head and finagling how they'll speak, and there's definitely an elegance to that. But there's also something fun about being able to share a text about a piece of science that we had put in our book 5 months before that article came out, and that moment of like, we did some pretty cool science maneuvering here. Like that, like having those moments is also really exciting. And I like to do that as well.
Gregory and I are kind of in the same studio here in Winnipeg, and we always are, and we're on a bunch of different projects together, and we're always talking about how more and more, like, as we get older or get deeper into the industry, it becomes more and more for us about, like, well, who do we want to work with, rather than, like, how much money do we want to make, or what's, even what's the project to some degree, like, takes a backseat to, like, well, do I want to hang out with this person and, like, work on a thing
Exactly.
with them, like, it becomes, and but especially if you're in comics, like, you're also doing some co-writing prose projects here, like those two books you mentioned, but especially in comics, I mean, like, unless you're a one-man show, you're working with other people in comics, and so
100%.
it's just natural to collaborate in that industry a little bit more, generally. And so what I've found just moving into comics more, is I didn't think I was going to be able to get rid of my control freak aspect enough to really enjoy it. I had to work at it, to kind of realize,
Totally.
okay, I can't tell Greg, like, if I tell Gregory what to draw, he won't do it. Like, he'll do something maybe like it, maybe,
Or he'll do something completely different to spite you.
often, but still, but he'll, but it'll be better. Like, but if I let go of it enough, it'll be better, and I can come back and rethink of what I was doing, and then I get better. If you have the right attitude, that collaboration, not only can you produce better work and more work, frankly, but also I find, like, you can, you kind of can stretch and grow as an artist, because you're getting pushed to do things that you literally wouldn't do otherwise, because you would just avoid doing it.
Totally.
So,
Totally.
how do you connect with collaborators then? Like, what's your sort of process to kind of get a collaboration going, or how do you decide what things you're going to collaborate on versus, you're just going to do yourself?
Totally. I think generally my initial reaction is always, let's do it together. No, there's rarely even I'm working on another prose series with a buddy named Don. And that was a idea that I had on my own that I thought was really interesting. And then I met Don. He had done some work with us at Hero, which is my creative agency. And I just really loved the way that he deconstructed ideas. And I hit him up and asked him if he wanted to work on it together, and he was into it. Because it is sort of like that math check, right? I definitely think, you know, if you think something's cool, that's great. It could be. I'm not saying it's not, but if you and somebody else that you're not like lifelong friends with thinks it's cool, then you're probably onto something. And I think that having that constant feedback loop, that ability to like fact check the art, the story, the production, is just useful as a creative. So I really enjoy the collaboration process because it sort of gives you real time feedback onto if something's good. That's not to say that doing it alone again is not fun. There's a handful of projects that I'm penning myself and producing myself and doing all that, which I have a ton of fun playing with the characters in my mind. But I do think that there's also a lot of fun with doing it with someone. I want to take a slight detour for a second before I forget this, but I did not know the name of this podcast before you said it. It's What Writers Do Wrong.
Writing the wrong way. Yeah.
Writing the Wrong Way. I
You know why
love
I call it that, Matt? It's because when you start out as a writer, you suck and you're doing
terrible.
things wrong.
Oh, it's so bad.
And what you do is you like, if you're
You think
smart,
it's good.
you
You
think it's
think it's
good.
good.
But now if you're smart, you realize it's not good. At a certain point, you start to get really frustrated because you start to realize that you're doing something wrong and you start to try to figure out, well, how do I do things the right way? And you know, you go and you take classes or you read books or whatever, you learn the right way to do it. But the problem with that is this. So that's all well and good up until this point. At a certain point, once you're learning how to do it, quote unquote, the right way, you pass a point where now you're doing it like everyone else. And now you have to unlearn it. Because actually, something you were doing wrong originally is actually the defining thing that's going to make you good. And you should be, yes, change this, change that, change the other thing. But there's something you're doing that you should be doubling down on doing it even wronger. Like just figure out how to make it work. And if you look at a really, really good writer, like a really impressive talent, they're doing something wrong. Like they're doing something that somebody else would say was wrong, except that they're making it work.
Yes,
So I've, you know what I mean? Like, and
100%.
so much what your style is or who you are, like in terms of the thing that moves you away from other writers, like the thing that kind of makes you who you are as a writer, as opposed to just one of the masses of writers that are all identical. So often that thing is something that a person would tell you is a mistake and you shouldn't be
So
doing it.
I can give you a great example of that. My writing style on my books, have you read Above the Ground yet?
I haven't finished it, but I've started reading it, yeah.
Okay. So you hear it more in Above the Ground than you do in Kuiper. No, you hear it also in Kuiper. Just there's a lot of science in Kuiper, so it sort of drowns it out. But there's this like really conversational tone with the writing that almost makes you feel like you're writing that you're reading something that somebody sitting next to you is telling you. Like you're sort of hearing it like at a campfire. That's just sort of my writing style. I find it really fun to tell stories from the point of view that it sounds like someone else is in the room with you while you're reading it. A lot of people told me that that was the wrong way to write. And I was like, that's cool. But I think that that's like my stick. I think that like when I write something, I want it to be conversational and I want it to be feeling as if a group is reading it together.
It's yeah, like what I find with people is like, let's say that's their thing. They really like this kind of casual conversational style, but they're doing it badly. And so it sucks. And everyone's telling them, you know, it sucks and you just shouldn't be doing it. That's not what people normally do. You should do it more normally. Well, the problem that you get into, I find, is like one, if you push forward and learn how to do it more normally, the best case scenario is you sound like everyone else and you get less interested because that was the thing you liked about writing in the first place, right? That's what kind of like, well, I like that thing. Like, yeah, I eventually I realized I was doing it badly, but I still liked doing it. I was having fun. And now I'm not having fun anymore. Yeah, my stuff's publishable, but what it's just even I don't find it that interesting compared to other people. So it's hard to market it. Now that you have these writers who like they don't even know how to sell themselves because they don't even like their stuff that much, if it really gets down to it. But if you were to dig at your heels in and go, yeah, I'll learn all this other stuff, but I'm going to make this work. I'm going to figure out how to make this work. Yeah, I get that it's bad now, but there's got to be a way to make it work. Other writers, there are people who make this conversation style work. You know what I mean? And if you dig your heels in and eventually you get to the point where you can do it right, yeah, all of a sudden, like that's your thing, you know? And you don't have to do it every
100%.
time, but like it can become your thing, you know? And it's like now that's your selling point. Now that's actually what's keeping you. Making you marketable all of a sudden, weirdly, because you have what's in business they call a unique selling proposition, right? So you actually and but most importantly, you're having fun still, and you're actually like doing something. What actually it's funny that you mentioned that because one of the things that the thing that I first noticed about Above the Ground was, I flipped to the back when the book arrived. I just flipped to the back and I started reading the back cover copy, and what I loved and the back cover copy, it kind of lays the premise out for a second. Then it goes, my name is Betty Anders. And I was like, well, I've never actually heard a back cover copy do this. It's like written from the point of view of the character. And I thought, well, that's a really interesting, like a unique approach.
Have you read the back cover to Stable?
I did. I noticed that you did the same thing on Stable to some degree. And I was like, I really like that style. For but like that's not even part of the story technically. Like that's technically speaking, you're on the marketing material side of it. Like it's the back cover telling you about the book, and it does all that. But at the same, but it also like puts you in the character, so it's kind of moving you into the story a little bit, into the world. And I really it was something that just I noticed was unconventional. But I wondered immediately why I don't see it more often, because it just makes sense.
I don't know why either, and we do it on most of our books. And ironically, I had that on Kuiper, and I was convinced to be a little bit more traditional on Kuipers. And then I kind of, with the success that Kuipers had, basically said like, screw that, and I'm going to do it the way I want to do it on these back covers. I think all of the books now are sort of this first person narrative point. Because it's as you said, the book itself, the product is not just the pages. To me, the product is the entire experience with the book. Like if you've ever read or seen Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, the book that possesses Ginny Weasley, cover to back cover, is the Horcrux, is what is this manifestation of Tom Riddle that is taking her over and making her do these evil things. And I sort of think of the books in a similar way, because I'm obsessed with Harry Potter, that the second you're touching the book, you should be in the world. And I think that's just like one way to get there is, to your point, you have to make sure you check all the boxes, make sure you describe the story, make sure you answer the big premise, and then the big lever, and what the resolution may be, right? Those are sort of like the three pillar points that you're trying to get in the back cover: the who, the why, and the when. And then, but the dressing of that can be, I think, more fun than traditionally it's been.
Yeah, and if you're in the bookstore, and you're looking at a book and you're looking at the back. I knew a guy who Matt once he didn't put the title. He had this great image for his cover that he had gotten this artist to do, and he had an argument with the publisher. He convinced them not to put the title on the cover. His argument was, look, you're not going to pay for front placement. He goes, everyone's just going to see the spine. The title's on the spine. Yeah, you can put a mock-up of the title on the cover
That's
for the
cool.
internet. He goes, but why ruin the cover with this stupid with these stupid words? Like it works for this book, but his book he had a really different design, and he
Pete
eventually,
Russo calls.
got his way.
Shout out to Pete Voodoo
I
Bones
love
Russo.
this cover, by the way. Yeah.
That cover's amazing. So Isaac Escorza did the art, and then Pete Russo who's been like my creative director and business partner at Hero for a decade now, which is like crazy to say out loud, did the design and masterfully put that logo in the volcano, which was epic.
Yeah, this is above the ground for people who aren't looking at the video. Is, you know, check out above the ground on the internet. You know, Google Matt Menney above the ground, and you know, buy that book. But also look at the cover and how that is designed. But yeah, like why not have the back of the book if you're in the bookstore or something? You know, or even flipping around online marketplace. Why can't the back cover be like, hey, you know, look, dudes, like this book is great. like why can't it be like more like what somebody would actually say to convince you to buy the book? And, you know,
totally.
Like the reason so often, like why people buy books is word of mouth. So
oh,
why
sure.
not have a more casual kind of like word of mouth sort of, yeah, it's hitting all the points, as you say. In this case, you're getting all the premise of, you know, what are the issues? What's the, I love this idea of quantum entangled botany, by the way.
I have to say I was inspired by The Martian, obviously.
Oh, sure.
And loved how they took that character and made a botanist also a survivalist. Right? I thought that was really, really cool. And then I was like, how do you take that to another level? And sort of had this idea for Above the Ground, and that was sort of like one of the birthing ideas of it. But one of the other things before I forget, because I keep tangenting myself, I'm actually starting my own Substack newsletter called The Writer's Take.
Oh, nice.
Which would be a good companion to Writing the Wrong Way. I'm not focused as much on how to write, be it right or wrong. More, there are some educational things that we're going to do that are like how to find your art team in a graphic novel, how to whittle down a big idea into a single word. But the real fun of it is taking multimedia projects and giving my take on them in a really satirical, over-the-top caricature of myself tone.
Nice.
I've written the first handful. We're launching it next week. My buddy Harrison and I are doing it, and it is it's just going to be like fun, free thing for people to read and whatever, but it's really funny. And I thought of it instantly when I heard you say at the beginning, this is Writing the Wrong Way. I was like, oh, I didn't even know the name of the podcast. That's amazing.
No, that's great. And so by the time people hear this, it'll be out already.
Yeah.
The Writer's Take.
Yeah, The Writer's Take.
Medney. The other just quick thing I want to hit on, maybe before I let you go here, is in Stable, you've got this great device that, you know, I it was kind of interesting because, again, you and I have a bit of a secret project that we'll talk about more fully some other time when we've got our other collaborator here on and stuff. But one of the things that we had in, we were kind of throwing out in the room there, was putting these ads for like products and things into the comic. And you were like, I actually did that. And you're like, I love that idea. I've already been doing that. And then, you know, we saw the Stable book come out, and you have the really, I love this sort of tactic, this narrative tactic of putting like interspersed with the story or between scenes, you've got like an ad or a photo, you know, actually that one, you know, or some other, you know, just sort of interjection almost, is like a visual interjection that gives a bit of the larger sense of the world. You know, they're doing these, it's doing this world building, and it has like its own interest and like fun, these like little poster sort of pages. It's not really necessarily advancing the direct plot lines, but it was really kind of giving, providing an expansiveness. I'm curious to know, like, where you kind of, how you just, why you decided to incorporate that particular technique into the story.
Yeah. And we, my team at Hero and I, which, we are responsible for, Stable, Remnant, the Fifth Force, our books, and all of those have these sort of what we call fake ads, right? They're real in-world ads, but they're not for real products. And I think our thought process was there's really interesting things that happen in these worlds that aren't necessarily part of the story, but are critical to maybe the lingo, the shorthand, items that you might see in and around if you're really analyzing the art. And we wanted to give those things a moment to shine. So for instance, in Stable, there's a page on Stacks, which is the financing system on the Arcs. It explains how money works on these intergalactic ships. And other than that ad, we don't spend time in the dialogue explaining how it works. People just use Stacks to buy. There's a burger scene where they use some Stacks to buy. So instead of having to waste dialogue or weirdly incorporate a exposition of how something might get used, there's a fake ad for that. There's another fake ad for Caleb Paulson. And that ad is really there just to showcase the breadth of elitism and honorarium that he has within the regular world, that he is this trusted psychologist. And that ad sort of takes a step that way. There's a handful of pro and against climate change ads that sort of give you a sense of the turmoil that was happening on the planet prior to the events of the book. Similarly, in Remnant and Fifth Force, there are ads that sort of, to your point, not push the main story forward, but expand the world so that you can understand the paradigm of where you're living. A lot of stories, I don't want to say cop out, but maybe don't emphasize the ancillary building of their environment enough, because they either go the cheap route by saying that it's relatively the same world, maybe 20 years in the future, or other devices that allow you to lean on various other real world applications. But with our books, we go pretty far into creating unique worlds that will allow people of our generation and hopefully future generations feel connected to the story, that timeless feeling, but not necessarily have the story be so relevant in the time. And because of that, you have to spend some pages and some art and some inspiration in articulating how some of those mechanics may or may not work.
What I also like about it, because the other thing that many stories will do is almost go too far in the other direction too, right? It's like just over explain this world to you and like, well, what's the story? But so what I like about it is like it's a short, like in the words of Pink Floyd, it's a short, sharp shock, you know, and you get like this big like blast of world building, especially in comics where, you know, you get the whole picture is worth a thousand words sort of thing. And as you say, yeah, you get information that now I can use to contextualize this actual story scene that's going to happen later. Like you mentioned Stable aboard the Ark. There's this altercation. This woman can't get the burger she wants because she's used up. She didn't realize her credits were expiring and she couldn't get them. She couldn't stack them up. And like she used to do with her money back in the day, you know, when she was on Earth, you know, like, so you get into it, it just very quickly gets you into a whole set of like economic and class differentials and like how that, just the technical process of how this thing works. And, you know, we got that information because we saw the ad, but she wasn't paying attention to the ad. And so she didn't get the information, you know, so it's really clever, like how it, and subtly how it kind of builds into the storyline in a kind of particular interesting way. I also just love it personally because the thing I hate the most in comics is ads. So I love the idea that you would have like a comic that you wouldn't have real ads in, but you would like where you could have put an ad, you know, it's like, an extra FU to the ads, and to me, it's
Yeah,
like I will put an ad here, but it's not your ad, I just love
and
like the attitude of it.
I think there's something so special about if you look at a graphic novel from the perspective of, I'm going to hand this to Hollywood and they're going to make a movie. Whether that happens or not, irrelevant. But if that's the mindset, then you start thinking about not just the story or not just the world, but the holistic package, because all the elements of these books have all the elements needed for a series Bible or for a film Bible. And that's sort of where that inspiration comes from, is we're building a world that we want to see on screen. And if we want to see it on screen, how do we see it on the page? And that's sort of when we're even writing these stories out, because for those three books, Stable, Remnant, and Fifth Force, I wrote those in collaboration with Morgan. We created the story with the entire team at Hero, Pete and Johnny included. Pat obviously was on the Fifth Force as well. And something that we always say in these writing rooms is, we might not know instantly how to write it, but tell me how you would see it on screen. And something that's important that I'm sure you've talked about, the translation's not one for one. Something that works on the page doesn't work on the screen, and vice versa. But if you can articulate how you might want to see something and the emotion, like there could be a scene that something happens that's so shocking that the captain drops his mug. Now, dropping a mug in a comic might be really hard because every movement, every action is its own panel, right? But if you talk about it from that point of view, what we were able to do in one of our stories was the mug actually fell on the left side of a page, and then there were panels on the right side, so it felt like it was falling through the panels, right? So we were able to deconstruct it after we had this sort of vision for how it may look. And I think that sort of inspiration or thinking is only really possible if you're looking at your story from multiple directions. You're obviously going to look at it from a writing perspective because you're writing it. But I challenge writers who are listening to this to start thinking also, how does that scene happen on screen? Even if you're never going to do that, even if you're writing it and you're like, I'm pure to the writing style and I just want it to be on the page, I'm not really looking to make it into any other sort of adaptation, I still think that perspective when you're constructing the panels will be really helpful in creating something unique that does not feel reused or pedestrian, but a unique style of paneling based on your mind's eye of how you would actually see that scene working.
Yeah, that's a great point and great nod to also to just the visual power both of film and comics, but especially I think the way that comics has this interesting problem solving aspect. It really is a tricky but powerful medium comics because. I forget who somebody once said it before me. I got this from somebody, but if there's one you could draw once, unlike a film, one spaceship or 100 spaceships is cost the same in comics.
Exactly.
A spaceship and a flower cost the same.
Yes.
And so yeah, you could show them flower and maybe, but maybe get a spaceship in there.
Exactly. Exactly. And to that point, right? If you see it on screen as 1,000 ships, well, you're probably not going to do that for the screen, but you're like, well, I can do it on this page. So fuck it. Let's do it.
Well, Matt, it's been so great chatting with you, and I'd love to have you back to chat some more sometime. But you've got so many things going on, we couldn't cover them all, but let people know where they can find all that information. So I know you just revamped your website. Where's the best place to follow you and to find that more information about that Substack and everything?
Yeah, so I'm at Matthew Medney, MatthewMedney on all socials. Heroprojects.io is our website. Something we hadn't even gotten to cover, and maybe we'll do it on a subsequent, is I actually am also writing a video game called Star Atlas right now. It's a multiplayer, online, blockchain-enabled space game. It's pretty awesome and epic. So I'm writing all the lore, backstory, the different routines throughout the game. For that's really, really fun. Really highly recommend checking it out, staratlas.com. The Writer's Take will have the website, thewriterstake.com. Will also be a Substack. You'll be able to find all that information on my socials as well. And yeah, I think, what do you think, in the next 2 or 3 months, we can maybe launch our secret project? I think once we get the coloring done on that cover, we'll be able to start talking about it to some people.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we're, yeah, I don't want to say too much about it, one, because it's still a bit of a secret project, but two, like, it's not right to talk about it too much unless we have Gregory and some other people here, maybe.
I completely agree.
But it's going to be cool, man. You know, we got a epic text thread filled up with just cool stuff going on here, and I can't wait for people to see some of the other stuff that's happening behind the scenes. But yeah, let's get back together and talk about Star Atlas specifically as well. Like, I do a lot of work, freelance work in the video game space, so it would be a great conversation to have with you. Although I think it's kind of its own conversation in many respects. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks again so much for chatting with me, Matt. Everyone check out heroprojects.io and all those other places, Matt. At Matt Imedi can be found. Keep up the good work, Matt, and keep writing the wrong way.